You've heard the incredible story told in the new book, Aliens in the Forest, the Cisco Grove UFO Encounters by Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte. We're opening up the phone lines. I'm George Knapp in tonight for George Norrie, and we'll be right back after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to the phone lines east of the Rockies, Daniel in Fort Smith, Arkansas. Good morning, Daniel. We'll go west of the Rockies, John in Lancaster, California. Hi, John. How you doing?
Real good. Hey, I love the show. I listen to Coast almost every night, and if I'm not working the next day, except I'm doubting the precept of this whole thing, that an experienced back road hunter with heavily armed at dusk, only a few miles from his camp, would choose to spend the night in a tree instead of just walking the few miles back to camp. I can't understand that. I've climbed all the mountains from Utah to Baja, all through the Sierras, so I know what I'm speaking about. So I doubt, I'm questioning why this heavily armed person with the hunting bows would choose to go up a tree rather than walking the few miles back to camp.
Fair enough. Noe, Ruben?
Okay, there's a couple of points there. Heavily armed, he had three arrows in his possession. Also, it was extremely dark at night. This is a very rocky, hilly terrain with canyons and ravines. He was not completely familiar with that area. He was more or less of an occasional hunter, went out on weekends with buddies. He wasn't really a diehard going out every weekend sort of hunter. He was just, you know, he had only been hunting a handful of times prior to this incident. And as I mentioned, the rocky terrain would have made it very easy for him to turn an ankle, to maybe slip down a ravine. Also, prior to this episode, there had been a lot of news coverage about bears being loose in the Cisco Grove area, and they had been seen by hunters and people in the area. So he was very concerned about the possibility of encountering a bear. So obviously, you know, and Ruben and I have looked into this. It's a common tactic for a hunter that's separated from other members of his party who is in a dark wooded area like this, alone, to seek a place of shelter. If not in a tree, then perhaps in some other sheltered rock outcropping or something, in order to be safe from predators. So this isn't out of the ordinary at all.
Okay, well, that if you'd said that up front, that'd be okay, because I'm thinking as a back road, I've climbed all the mountains from Utah to Baja and everywhere else, and I'm thinking, this guy is just a hunter. He goes up a tree. Had you said that up front, it'd been a whole different understanding. Well, thank
well now,
you,
now you understand it, though.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Anything to add, Ruben?
Yeah, actually, there was another case that I had was looking into, and the gentleman mentioned that he's been down in Baja, and this actually happened where there were a group of hikers. Actually, there were three young men that were hiking there and on the other side of the border, an area known as the Rumba Rosa. It's a stretch of desert and very rocky mountainous area as well. And these young men had hiked, and they went too far, and they also climbed up a tree, and they also, for the reason that there were a lot of rattlesnakes out there, and they kept encountering them. But one of the things that very similar to the Shrum case is that as they climbed up the tree and waited until it got dark, they saw a bright light and they thought it was a helicopter, but it was also turned out to be a spaceship that came very close. And it went right above the tree above them. And it also, these guys had observed these beings actually not paying attention to them, but rather to the plants and to the trees, the fauna, and the plant life and the animals around that. It wasn't until later they started to put the focus on them. So Mr. Jaime Malsan had did an extensive investigation on that case there. So there's some similarities on with that and with our story.
But Shrum was, as you mentioned, it's totally dark out there. It's fairly unfamiliar territory for him, and he basically was disoriented and essentially lost.
It was dangerous for him to come back, that being so rocky, a rocky terrain, and as Noah mentioned, he climbed up the tree for safe haven.
And he lit a fire, to attract the attention of his fellow hunters, and that sort of backfired on him?
Well, he thought that light that was coming at him was possibly a rescue helicopter from the Forest Service. That was his initial thought, which when he climbed down and lit those two fires, and it turned out, of course, it wasn't the helicopter.
Okay. First-time caller, Jamie in Blairsville, Georgia. Hi, Jamie. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, what's on your mind?
In 1994, I was coming back from Atlanta on 129, just south of Blairsville, and it was a very bright moonlit night, not a cloud in the sky, and I noticed a very large shape coming out of the sky. And I pulled over to take a good look at it in this curve. Now, this area, the embankment drops off about 30 feet off the side of the road and goes down to a river. And this craft hovered about maybe a dozen feet above the tree line, just above the river, about 600 feet from where I was at. But I noticed that it was a boomerang-shaped craft, but had absolutely no sound, no windows, no light at all, and had a textured surface, like a golf ball, almost like surface. And I stood there watching this. I'm thinking, is this a military craft or what? But there was no propulsion of any kind you could hear, no sound. I noticed that there was almost like a whirlwind coming out from underneath it above the river, because you could see the trees sort of whip around as it was moving over the trees. But south of me is the Dobbins Air Force Base and also Lockheed Aeronautics, which made me wonder if this was a private military craft or maybe a rear-engineered alien captured craft. I was wondering what your thoughts might be on that, of seeing a craft with no lights, no sound, and a texture like that on some sort of craft like this.
Does this ring a bell to either of you?
Yeah, well, over the years, we do get, through our MUFON database, we get a number of reports. In fact, we have 23 categories that describe the different types of shapes of objects, and the boomerang is definitely one of them. The most common seen object that usually is reported are more like the orb-shaped objects. Then it's broken down by saucers, a chevron-shaped object, and that. But the fact that it's very quiet, no sound, then it makes that's where it gets really interesting for the investigator to find out what could it be, and is it Earth-like or can it be from another world? That's always the challenge.
But it's hard to tell anymore as advanced as some of these craft.
Yeah. Technology and then the advances that has gone on tremendously. So it makes it much, much more difficult.
What about the golf ball texture he's talking about? Does that ring a bell?
No. In fact, when he described that, I envisioned in my mind the type of texturing that would be. And, that could be a form of stealth or who knows. That's interesting.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks for the call. East of the Rockies, Brian in Pennsylvania. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, I had a rather strange experience. At 10 years old, I asked my mother to buy me a telescope for my birthday, and she did. I mean, it was a cross between a toy and, suitable for a 10-year-old. But one night, I set it up across the street from our house, and I was looking through it, moving it real slow, and all of a sudden it came into view, this thing with just like multicolored lights blinking, and I'm like, I took my eye off the telescope and I couldn't see anything. So I looked at it again and it was right there, and it was blinking. It was like a triangular type vessel is the only way I can describe it. But I was getting ready to go back home because it was getting late, and I got hit with like a white light. I mean, it was incredibly bright, and I came to, I guess. I got home, and my mother said to me, she was really cross. She goes, "Where have you been?" I said, "Well, I was right across the street." She goes, no, you weren't. We looked everywhere for you. Are you okay? And I said, yeah, I think I'm okay. So fast forward, I was 15. And this friend of mine and I, Mike, we went to, I don't know if you're familiar with Miami Beach, but they were going to tear down this 14-story old hotel called the Biltmore. And everybody said that, you know, that they moved everybody out, but it was haunted. So on a dare, Mike and I went up there, and he's ahead of me going up the steps. And he slipped and fell, like, on the landing. And then he turned around, and Mr. Knapp, trust me, I believe in demons, man. This thing, like, flipped me up. I just took off running. And from then on, I've had absolutely no emotion, no happiness, no joy, no anger, no hatred. You know, I don't know what happened, you know, because I remember as a kid I was pretty joyful. But I don't know what that craft would be doing over my neighborhood, but who knows why they do what they do. And I'm just curious if you think the two of those, you know, my lack of emotion and this sighting might be, I don't know, somehow woven together. And thank you for taking my call, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, Brian, that's a new one to me. Have either of you heard anything like that about an emotional, long-term emotional effect on someone after having an encounter?
Well, there are some elements to the story that are similar to Travis Walton's case, where he was blasted by this blinding white light that came down from the hovering UFO. And he was knocked about 30 or 40 feet and rendered unconscious. His buddies, the other loggers in the forest that evening, thought that he had been killed or seriously injured, which is what motivated them to flee the scene. And you know, they left Travis there alone. And talking to Travis just a few weeks ago, we appeared together at the Laredo UFO conference here in Laredo, Texas. He now feels that the occupants of the UFO actually came back for him because of the condition that he was in, and actually worked to revive him. And that's the reason that they kept him for 5 days. He was apparently being brought back to life, is how he feels now. So he doesn't feel so much that that they did something negative to him. So in that, you know, in that respect, there's some similarities to what this gentleman did, but there was no memory loss per se, or a change in the emotional structure of him.
You know, you mentioned about Donald Trump having that other episode while camping with his family. As we know from modern abduction cases, these experiences tend to happen over and over again within the same family, that it follows generations. I'm curious whether any other member of the Shrum family has had some kind of experience of their own.
Well, we worked very closely with Don's son, Dan, who lives with his folks right now and is taking care of them. They're both in very poor health, as we've mentioned. And Dan has not shared with us that he has had any experiences of his own. However, he strongly believes that in what his dad has told him and the reality of it, and has seen over the years how it has affected both his dad and his mom. So that is a very real thing to him. Ruben, have you had any contact with other of the Shrum family members that might have seen something?
No, nothing in terms of anything unusual, but I'm sure that later, as we get more into the story, it's a very large family. So,
Tell me this: where does the story go from here? Are there pieces out there, answers that you're still seeking, other bits of information that you hope you can follow up on?
Mr. Shrum would very much like to have his arrowhead that was taken away by the Air Force and never returned. He feels that it's in storage somewhere. And he feels that is a key piece of evidence in this case. And But other than that, Reuben, can you think of anything else that, that might help to even lend further credibility?
Yeah, actually what Dan had shared this with me, that he was very much interested to see whether around that time period, if anyone else, or there have been other reports, which we need to look at, what was being, during that particular weekend, or other cases very similar. So there's a lot more research we'll need to do.
The other thing is, Reuben, that in my conversation with Travis Walton a few weeks ago when we were in Laredo together, he mentioned that they did research on the vegetation around where the UFO was seen in his case, and they found that the growth of the trees in the surrounding forest had been altered beginning on the very year of the encounter that he had. They analyzed the tree rings, and they found a tremendously accelerated growth, like 5 or 6 times the normal growth of the tree up to that point. These were very old trees that had been there for many, many decades, and their growth pattern on those tree rings was very consistent up until the UFO encounter that Travis Walton had, and then there was this burst of growth in the surrounding forest. So one of the things that I'd like to see is more analysis of the vegetation and the trees in the area where this immense UFO was seen by Mr. Shrum.
And is the tree still there?
Yes, the tree is still there as far as we know. Reuben, have you heard?
We're looking into planning a trip, and when the weather gets a lot better, to go up there in that area and do some hiking for several days and look at that particular area where hopefully the tree is still there, and look at the vegetation and do some analysis.
We're going to a break in a second. I know you mentioned the second hunter who did provide a statement. What about the third hunter? It sounded from the book, what you wrote, that he has not been. It's not that he's uncooperative, it just hasn't been available to talk to you about what he remembers.
Well, Tim Trueblood was a third hunter. He was also a welder for the Aerojet Corporation. And he did not see, you know, all three men were separated from each other. Alvarez, the second hunter, he saw the UFO initial appearance descending out of the Earth's atmosphere, but Trueblood never saw that. His attention was not on that particular part of the sky or whatever, but he never saw anything. However, what would have been interesting is if he could have also given an affidavit as to the condition that Mr. Shrum was in after he made his way back to camp following the encounter. And that's why several folks have attempted to get a hold of Mr. Trueblood, but it's been kind of difficult over the years to find him, and he was last reportedly living in Hawaii. So he's never made a public statement in the case, although we do know, of course, that he himself did not witness the UFO. He could have some interesting comments to make about Mr. Shrum's condition following the event.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of listeners, coast-to-coast listeners in Hawaii, so if you know a guy named Trueblood who might be the guy we're looking for, maybe mention this to him that the authors of this book could use his input. We're taking a break. We'll come back with more of your questions for my guests, Noe Torres and Reuben Uriarte, after this on Coast to Coast AM. And this is Iggy Pop, the passenger, taking us into the break. As I listened to the story told by my guests, Noe Torres and Reuben Uriarte, about their new book, Aliens in the Forest, it makes me think about the legacy of Project Blue Book. There are those who still regard Project Blue Book as an honest study of the UFO phenomena, when in reality what it was is a PR exercise, a way to explain away UFOs, to strip them of their aura of mystery, to make the public less interested in them, to try to explain away UFO encounters and incidents, no matter how lame the explanation might be. And in this case, the Cisco Grove UFO encounter, the attempted explanation was lame indeed. We do know, though, because of the Freedom of Information Act, that after Project Blue Book was canceled in 1969, an Air Force general put out this memo, which basically said, okay, Project Blue Book is dead, but all those UFO cases involving national security, the files should continue to go where they have always gone. Now, where that is, we don't know, because those files have never been released. But somewhere, there's probably a pretty interesting collection of credible and incredible UFO cases, and chances are we're never going to get to see those. We continue our conversation, go back to the phone lines with as many of your questions as we can get to here on Coast to Coast AM. Noe and Ruben, I hope that the reaction to the book so far, I know it's just out, but I hope the reaction has been very positive for you.
Oh, thank you, George. So far, we're starting to get really good feedback from a number of people, and we're hoping that it'll continue.
Well, it's a good read. It's a fun, crisp read. I think that people will enjoy it if they check out the book, Aliens in the Forest. We go now to our international line, Brent in Canada. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Yeah, I got a question for you. I'm an over-the-road truck driver. I was out in Virginia on the 85 headed northbound. I seen a shooting star, a real bright light. I was about to make a wish and whatnot. And as I was about to make a wish, it slowed down. Now, I was wondering, have you ever heard of something like this before?
Well, have you heard anything like that, Ruben, where a UFO is seen and it reacts in some sort of a psychic connection?
Absolutely. There's a book that was put out by Dr. Richard Haynes that wrote, I'm trying to remember what the title, I believe, was Close Encounters of the Third or Fourth Kind, but basically, in many of those cases that he outlined, was this phenomena connected with the actual connection between the mental processes of the witness and possibly the connection with that with UFO sighting. So there might be a connection with what this gentleman had mentioned.
Hey, I have another question, if possible.
Okay.
I was talking to my other friend, and I didn't want to seem crazy, so I figured I could mention it to him because he's over the road too. And he was out in Texas, and he said out in Texas near Mexico, he said he see him all the time. He said sometimes they'd be chasing behind each other. It'd be like one or two of them chasing behind each other, and all of a sudden the light would just go out on them.
Hey, Noe, he's from Texas, though. Noe, you may want to.
Well, that's interesting because we just had a major UFO event here along the Texas-Mexico border in Laredo last month, and we heard many, many stories about increasing the number of sightings, reports of sightings along the Texas-Mexico border and throughout the state of Texas. Something has happened, I think, since the Stephenville UFO sightings a couple of years ago, that people have become more focused on keeping an eye out for these UFOs. And so I think that that's probably part of the reason that we're starting to see a lot more sighting reports come in. And we see this on the MUFON database for the state of Texas, an increasing number of sightings. And there seems to be especially intense activity for some reason along the Texas-Mexico border.
Brent, you stay safe out there on the highways east of the Rockies. Dave in eastern Pennsylvania. Good morning, Dave. We're going to Betty in Los Angeles, west of the Rockies. Hi, Betty.
Hi, how are you this evening?
Okay.
Okay, I'm surprised I got in. I was so surprised when he answered that I started blathering. I really think that I've seen... Ever since I was a child in Pennsylvania, my whole family has seen things in the sky. And I lived in Indiana in the later parts of the 90s than they're talking of. But one night I had my children and one of the neighbor kids who was just learning how to drive. And everything in Indiana is laid out in mile grids. And we were going north. She was practicing driving. I had the kids in the car. I was actually pregnant at the time. And we saw ahead of us, it was in the sky, and it was obviously, it was almost dark, but it was quite bright. And my little driver friend said, "What is that?" And I said, "Please let me drive." So I slid over, and she got around and got in the other car. And the closer I got, it actually was this big light. Three little lights dropped out and kind of acted like they were playing, little kids, and then they went back up into the light. And I said, okay, and I started to turn around because the kids were a little bit scared. and I started to turn around, and it started tracking me. And I believe that once you have had, it's not a close encounter the third time. I know I've never been abducted, but I believe there's some kind of a connection, because I, in my mind, I wasn't desperate. I was very clear, and I was saying, these are my responsibility. These children are my responsibilities. Please, please back off. Well, the closer I got to town, they backed off and they went away. Well, about a year later, I was by myself. I was coming home from work, and it was about 11 o'clock at night, and I noticed off to the side this light, and it was like it was tracking me. I pulled up into my driveway. I stopped the car, and it swooped down on me, and off it went. Now, I've lived in 6 states. The only state that I haven't seen these things is in California, but I've always lived in populated areas, and I haven't spent much time out in the country where you can have a clean sight to the sky. So I believe these things somehow. You mentioned that the gentleman, Mr. Strum, has this weird buzzing in his ears. I don't have any buzzing, but I will tell you, before I have seen these things, I knew they were there. Mm. Thanks for your... Really, thanks for this program. It's been great.
Thanks, Betty. Ruben, does that ring a bell?
Well, yes. What really impresses me is that how people are sharing their stories, probably for the first time on Coast to Coast, and at the same time, the fact that they're sharing the cases and it enables other people to open up and share. So this whole psychic phenomena, this whole question, this connection is very, very interesting.
Is Don Shrum, is he listening tonight? Is his wife listening?
I'm not sure if Don is. I did send an email to them, and I believe Dan, his son, most likely is listening to the story, but. Hopefully, as you mentioned earlier, we could get a copy of and then be able to share it with them in case they didn't listen.
Well, we'll see what we can do, and I want to thank them if they are listening for sharing their story with the world. Noe?
I wanted to mention, George, that this concept of an intense psychological connection between the observer and these UFOs was also quite evident in this Shrum case, because as we spent time talking to Mr. Shrum and looking over his testimony and the documents in the case, what we discovered was that he himself viewed the whole experience as being an intense psychological connection and battle. He explains it in terms of they were trying to get in his mind, and he battled tremendously with every ounce of his being to try to avoid being taken. And so, like the caller that we just heard from, who said that she focused on her children and needing to protect them, and the object went away. And that struck me because Mr. Shrum tells the story of how he focused on his wife and their young daughter while he was up in the tree. And he was so focused on that that I think it gained him an advantage in this psychological warfare with these beings. And perhaps it was the tipping point that made it possible for him to avoid capture.
Well, a good thing to keep in mind, I guess, if folks have similar encounters. Thanks, Betty, for the call. First-time caller, Ryan in Canada. Good morning, Ryan.
Hi, George. It's, hello?
Hello?
Hi, George. It's Ryan calling.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I actually saw something. It was sometime in the evening, and it was actually moving like a serpent. And I actually did take a few pictures of it, and I looked at it really closely, and it turned out that it was actually a dragon. And I don't know Quite honestly, I think it might have been a dragon or not, but it was moving like a serpent.
You mean an actual dragon as opposed to something shaped like a dragon?
Yeah, it was moving like, it looked like a giant serpent, like one of those Japanese, Chinese dragons.
Hmm. And you said you have photos?
I actually have a photo of it, yeah.
And the photo shows like something looking like a serpent or a dragon.
Yeah, it's really long, and one part it showed looked like horn. Like it's kind of blurry because it was moving pretty fast. I didn't like when I first noticed it. I saw something shiny, like moving like a serpent, and then I went to get my camera and I took a picture of it.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ryan, if you've still got a picture of it, hang on the phone lines. Jason, our call screener, would be interested in contacting you, and maybe you can send it to us, and we can put it on the Coast to Coast website so everyone can see it. That's pretty interesting. There are, reports of weird creatures and reptilian creatures, even dinosaur-looking things, right, that we, Noe and Ruben, encounter in this strange endeavor.
Oh, we did a book recently, actually. John LeMay, who is a historian in Roswell, New Mexico, and myself, called The Real Cowboys and Aliens, UFO Encounters of the 1800s. And we included a chapter about the flying serpents that have been seen. We had an outbreak of many flying serpent, flying dragon type UFO sightings throughout the 1800s. Part of the purpose in our doing that book was we wanted to clarify misconceptions resulting from the recent Spielberg movie. You know, the alien encounters of the Old West did actually happen. There, we found hundreds of similar cases. And it's interesting what the caller just said, that describing this as kind of a flying serpent or flying dragon, because that's exactly what many of the cases that John LeMay looked and I looked at, that's the description. In many cases, the object seemed to be some kind of ship that maneuvered in the manner of that we would think of as a serpent moving along the ground, except up in the sky, you know, wriggling back and forth. But in other cases, it seemed to be an organic being, you know, rather than a flying machine. So there are instances of both.
Wow, I'd like to read about that. Ryan in Canada, thanks for that call, and I hope you feel a little bit better now that that you know that other people have had similar kinds of experiences. Wildcard line, Sharon in Santa Cruz, California, home to the banana slugs, right?
That's exactly right. And hi, Ruben.
Oh, hey, Sharon. How are you?
Hi. Where in Northern California was this?
Well, it's down Highway 80. It's going up toward past Sacramento, Auburn, in an area known as...
Okay, I know that. Okay.
It's close to Truckee, actually, as you're going up toward Truckee.
So near Tahoe and up in Gold Country.
Okay, I know where that is, too. Okay, now, I don't ever order anything on the Internet. How do I get the book without the Internet?
You can have it. You can have an order placed at your local bookstore.
Okay.
They won't have it on hand, but they can
order it.
Yeah, they'll have it for you in a few days.
Okay, good.
If you have a Barnes & Noble, that would be the best place to go.
There's no Barnes & Noble in Santa Cruz County.
If not, you can get almost any book retailer should order it. Should be able to order it for you as a special order.
And how do I get an autograph?
Well, Sharon, I have some books, so you afterwards you and I...
Right on, Ruben!
Yes.
Okay. All right, Sharon, thank you for the call. Okay. We'll try to get one more caller in. Scott in California. Hi, Scott.
Thank you
Hello.
For taking my call. Yes, hello?
Sure. Yeah, we're here. Okay. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to... say real quick, say something. I experienced the entire universe during a death experience that I had, and the Lord spoke. to me as I was experiencing the universe, and I was given all knowledge while I was experiencing it. And yes, it is it is teeming with life. I mean, beyond our imaginations. And the Lord said to me that, Scott, anything is possible. And anyway, my question is,
how... We have about 30 seconds here, Scott, okay. So you better get to this question pretty quick.
Yep. Why don't we... I know we have the Freedom of Information Act, but that apparently isn't doing squat as far as, you know, forcing a lot of things to be disclosed.
Hey, Scott, I'm going to have to cut you off. We're going to be going to the end of the program here. If you have a comment, Ruben or Noe, about the FOIA at all?
I was just going to suggest real quickly, this is just a plug that there's a number of people that may be listening and maybe have gone through some experiences and may need some assistance. There's an organization called FIS. You had Mr. Lester Velez on your show a while back, but I highly would recommend www.opus-net.org, and it's a great organization, and many of these people can call and get assistance.
That's true. They do good work. I know Les, and he does good stuff. Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte, the book is called Aliens in the Forest. I wish you both tremendous success with it. It's very readable and very important book.
Thank you, George, for having us on. And again, we have our website is www.roswellbooks.com.
Okay, well, we have a connection, the link on our Coast to Coast website. Thank you both for being here. Also, thanks to David Childress and to Dan and Jason and Lex there at Premier. George Norrie will be back soon. I'm George Knapp, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Good night, everyone.